It's time for ESPN Las Vegas legal insider Justin Watkins with Battleborn Injury Lawyers, only on ESPN Las Vegas and ESPN Reno.
All right, here we go. 4 o'clock hour. Justin Watkins in the Battleborn Broadcast Center. Willie Ramirez, Griffin's back in the Finley Toyota Studios. Much to get to. We were just talking a little NFL draft, believe it or not, on what's going to happen with Travis Hunter. Colorado's a fascinating follow the rest of the season, which to see what happens with Shedeur Sanders. People are really, it's funny what winning does. People are really starting to change their opinion, and I'm hearing some really lofty opinions of Shedeur Sanders. I'm sure that'll all change if they go 1-4 from here for the next five games, but good stuff to get into. I want to get to conference chaos in just a little bit because I know you have a lot to say, and we really didn't get you on to react to a bunch of the changes that happened, including UNLV staying with the Mountain West and then the action since. But I wanted to come out of the gates and start with, we need you as a mediator.
Okay.
We have an issue. We made a bet. We didn't really come to an agreement on the metrics of this bet. Willie and I last week said, were you here? Maybe we actually did it in front of him. Okay.
Yeah.
I put a number up.
Oh. I put 700,000. Remember, you guys were like, that's too low. Yeah.
I put up 975.
Yes, you did.
Right. I said over.
And the number came in at 929.
Yes.
Or did it?
It did. Well, you can't look at peak rating. Come on. That's not even a real metric. Nobody
gets
a peak.
It's 975 viewers per game.
Yes, average.
For the Aces. TV viewers.
Yes.
For the Aces and the Liberty, just to explain it to the audience. I said the over-under would be 975.
I took the over.
Willie took the over. I took the under. Numbers came in as the audience was 929,000, but the peak was 1.2 million. Mm. Now, I forgot that you got in on this bet, but you're out already, really.
I'm already out.
Because you said over-under would be 700,000. I didn't think of the peak number because I never look at the peak number. I don't care what the peak number is. But Willie does have a case here that maybe this bet is nullified.
No, nobody reports the peak number. Right?
Well,
I mean, Nielsen.
If nobody reports it, then why did we get it?
Well, of course you can find the information.
No, it's on the same report.
I know, but when you look at a listing of TV viewers and the ratings, and they just give you a single number.
Okay.
It's the average. You are never looking at the peak number.
Okay.
And for context, you guys were talking about last year's numbers and what they were. Mm-hmm. And you were talking about the average. You weren't talking about peaks.
It was in the 800s. It was 838 per game.
Okay,
for
that's fine.
WNBA.
I'll take the L.
No, I just want you to be. Because you know what? I'll admit, I am not used to people being agreeable on betting. You know, this would turn into hours of.
If our boy Adam, he would find a way to debate. But I mean, that's fine if it's.
You're close. You might have got it last night.
I saw the graphic. Most viewed WNBA semifinal in 22 years.
Right.
929,000 is the Nielsen rating. Viewership peaked at 1.2.
But
I said 1.2 saw it. At some point, 1.2 saw it. If we're going with average, then I take the L.
The graphic was also sent out by an absolute WNBA sycophant.
Yeah.
Who was trying to build the argument that, oh, I guess the audience didn't go away with Caitlin Clark. Well, Caitlin Clark in her game
Steve,
had 1.8 million.
Steve, that person got the graphic from a WNBA PR.
Yeah.
It came from the WNBA.
But I read
the number so that the number more supports her agenda.
Oh, her tweet, yes, definitely wanted to make a point that, oh, I guess the viewership didn't go now to Caitlin Clark. But what I'm saying is she didn't put it out and, I mean, that number was – was released by the WNBA.
Now,
her tweet was definitely slanted.
Now here you go. I'm going to defend Willie's position now and say this. Knowing Steve Cofield how I know Steve Cofield, knowing how he makes these bets, he is always about term, what's the measurable?
I know.
And that wasn't agreed upon.
I know.
Before. So Sloppy. By Steve Cofield's own rules, yep. I think we got a jump ball nullified bet.
Which I'm fine with. When I saw it this morning, I was like, oh, no, I didn't even think of the peak.
So we're basically...
We're back.
Basically, I'm Nafisa Collier, you're Marina Mabry. You're down there digging in the...
Did you see what happened?
No, I think what we really are, because we get along really well, we're basically Dejanay and...
Caitlin?
No, Nalissa?
Nalissa Smith.
You're my radio boo.
No. You guys are like,
By the way, you did see this was a Whitlock angle last week, which I knew would get everyone on the show going crazy. That Nalissa Smith, right?
Yeah.
That she wasn't playing hard again for Indiana against the Sun because she's in a relationship or has an affinity for DeJounay. And that thing's kind of
been in a relationship.
That whole thing's
since
fascinating
Baylor,
because
yeah.
we don't really have that in the W or the NBA that we know of.
Right. So I would say you guys are more like Tim Walz and JD Vance. I'll go more current. You guys very agreeable. You guys understood each other's positions. Sure. Very agreeable.
No reason to bicker.
Yes.
Spike Lee and Kelsey Plum.
There you go.
No. We have a lot of Spike Lee, Kelsey Plum relationships on the show. This is not one of them. Sometimes, every once in a while. But you, I was actually surprised. I was ready to duke it out with Willie by coming into the show basically saying the Aces were cooked. And he was like, well, it doesn't look good.
It doesn't. Yeah, they're going to have an uphill battle.
Yes.
But true to form, I haven't watched
it. It is what it is. Steve knows for the 2-3 years I've been on the show, I take an L and I admit, I say I'm wrong. I was wrong or whatever. I take it and whatever. I still owe him. I owe him 2 meals now.
Yeah.
Right. Not from this one. From a year or so ago and then recently or something, right?
Yeah.
So I'm down 2 meals.
I'm calling it a no contest. I'm going to say for the finals, you guys got to come up with new numbers.
It'll be
average. And then I'll.
How about this? Let's take the 2 numbers from 1 and 2 and 3. Right, whatever the series average is for the Aces Liberty, not the Sun Lynx, no matter who gets in the finals, it'll be less than the Liberty Aces average. Let's make that the number.
Oh,
I'll say it'll go under.
Under for sure, of course.
Not betting
that. Yeah, that's an easy under.
Yeah, you're like, how about this one? No, I agree with you. What's going on here with Shohei Ohtani and the 50-50 baseball and lawsuits and fans?
I'm sure people like hear the fact that there's a lawsuit about the 50-50 ball and they kind of roll their eyes and they're like lawyers and people. But I think it's a very interesting case, assuming facts to be true. There's two different people who say they have possession of the ball and that it was sort of stolen from them. The first one says the ball came in. I had a firm grasp on the ball. And a much bigger, older man jumped down, pinned my arm down under his knee, and ripped the ball out of my hand. Took it. When he ripped the ball out of the hand, it then rolls. He doesn't keep possession. It sort of rolls, and the guy who's selling it or attempting to sell it grabs it. He's got it. The second person is. Sort of in between those two, says, no, the ball's all around, I have it, and then somebody assaults me, takes the ball out of my hand, and then it rolls and ends up in the current possessor's hand. So all the people go, hey, man, you didn't get the ball, you don't get the ball, no sour grapes. But I think there's an interesting question about where the MLB wants to be in this conversation. You can't have it just can't be a free-for-all. I mean, you're putting your fans in danger if it's a free-for-all. Then just the biggest, meanest person ends up with all these things because, they're knocking people out or whatever they're doing to get the ball. At what point does somebody have legal possession, and at what point can somebody steal or the civil claim is conversion, convert somebody else's property into theirs? I think it's going to be very difficult without some great video evidence. Although one of the attorneys, in his brief submitted video evidence to show, look, we're in possession right here. It's tricky. And you know what I like about this case, and at least discussing it on air, is we have often talked about, or even the week before, last week we talked about whether or not, money damages can make somebody whole, and whether or not that would change what a court would do as far as granting an injunction or making somebody do something. We were talking about it in the context of exit fees and penalty fees. So here's an excellent example. You could say, well, decide this court case later. Let the guy sell the ball, and then whatever he gets for the ball, he would have to pay if he loses to whoever ultimately wins on the possession. But here's the thing. There is only one of those. There's only one Ohtani 50-50 ball. You can't make somebody sell their asset if it's one of a kind. It's truly one of a kind. So this is the situation in which money in and of itself is insufficient to compensate somebody for the wrong. So if the court determines that one or either of these two is likely to succeed on the merits, that's the key for an injunction, likely to succeed on the merits of the case, they haven't won, but they're likely to win, then an injunction absolutely will go in place, prevent the sale of the ball, and they will litigate this whole thing out before any sale can occur. Because what you can't have is that go into somebody else's hands who legally purchased it and attempt to unwind that. So there is a hearing for October 10th. It'll be I'm following it out of curiosity. I don't know how interesting it is to the listeners because they don't sound like crybabies, but I'm also interested to hear or see what MLB does in response to this, because you just can't put your fans in danger
right.
and encourage the type of behavior that allows people to be assaulted for memorabilia.
You saw the video?
Not in detail. I haven't watched all the details.
I've only seen one. I think there's only one angle, but I've sat there and watched it over and over and over and over again. I think that the kid... I don't see the kid winning this.
Okay.
I don't see the whole blow. The way it's described in his argument, I don't see that he had clear possession. I don't see that his arm was pinned. I see that the guy dropped down to his knees, so his arm was still between down there, but I never saw that he had possession in the first place. And I don't think that he did anything physically to assault him to get the ball. I don't see how the kid wins. I really don't see.
Well, you never know what kind of – they might have some other angles. They might have some cell phone, you know.
Yeah.
You know, if there's somebody in the audience is like, dude, that kid had it. I had on video and, you know, exchanges numbers with the person. So we might not be limited to one angle. It'd be interesting if MLB has other angles that they didn't share with the broadcast that they're willing to share not willing to share.
It could
be, subpoenaed by the court.
Yeah.
It would be interesting to see. But again, I think ultimately at the 30,000 foot elevation, people go, crybabies, you didn't get the ball. Let them do it. You know, this is sour grapes. And maybe so. Maybe it ultimately is. But I don't think that changes the fact that MLB should probably be proactive on this moving forward and create some sort of fan conduct code that's on the tickets and part of it that says, if you do this, you forfeit your rights, you know, so that it's already predetermined before you get to court that you already agreed contractually that you wouldn't do this and you did it. Yeah.
Justin Watkins, Willie Cofield, Battleborn Broadcast Center. We're live right now up on Twitter and Facebook and YouTube as well. Stick with us through the break. That's coming up in just a couple seconds. Some of our most loyal listeners from the old late night podcast days are up in the chat room. So Cam Fletcher's up there and he said, hey, I'm having flashbacks to the Late Night Legal Pod. He also joked, did the person make a football move to establish possession? Brady's up there as well. Brady said Mike Pereira needs to be brought in, kind of break things down about possession. So good to see some of our most loyal listeners are up there. Remember, Friday, Treasure Island is the spot. We'll be out there inside the Golden Circle Sportsbook and Bar. And we're there twice a week, Fridays and Saturdays, the award-winning Throw the Flag show on Saturday mornings, 9 to 11 a.m. with Jared and Danny, live at Treasure Island again every Saturday. And we're there on Friday. Earlier start this week. Earlier start 2 to 5 with Cofield & Company.
Live from the Battleborn Broadcast Center, it's Cofield & Company on ESPN Las Vegas and ESPN Reno.
Wednesdays are becoming a big time to update on conference chaos. Because you're into it, you know the legal side of things. Justin Watkins is who I'm addressing. Willie's here as well. Willie's very into it as well. I want to get to what happened the last week or so with more reorganization of the Pac-12 and the Mountain West Conference. But, my Lord, between this show and then other shows, and I appreciate people having me on shows around the country, I'm so tired of talking about NIL with regards to the Sluka story. I'm in NIL. I think it's fascinating.
A lot of national people came out and had an opinion. And I don't know that any of them really had a very well-founded opinion, that they sourced out both sides of the story with Sluka. But you saw Herb Street puffing out his chest about NIL?
Yeah, I mean, on College Game Day, he was basically saying, you know, the pendulum has these aren't his words. This is my interpretation of his words. That the pendulum has swung too far and the players can't have this level of power to, you know, everybody wants NIL and everybody wants to give the players, you know, what their rights are. But having this, you know, sort of free agency that's currently happening is not what is good for NCAA, and it's not what's good for college athletics, and you know, sort of we've overcorrected. Is my takeaway from what he was saying. And while that may be true, like maybe we are too far to that side without any guardrails, I think it's important to add context to that of how did we get here. And in my opinion, how we got here is the NCAA drew a line in the sand over 20 years ago, you know, goes to Obama. They made up this label of student athlete, and they stuck to it even while on the flip side they were turning this into big business. And the players over the course of a generation were not asking for this. They were asking for little bits and pieces along in the way, and they were like, no, none of it, because they felt like if they gave a little bit, yeah, that they would weaken their position and that they would lose. All the while, they were growing these revenues and turning this business and turning the work of these kids into billions of dollars for themselves, even while all administrators and all coaches had all the free agency that they wanted to do what they wanted with their careers. They provided none of that for these kids. And, you know, if they had had some foresight to, I don't know, give some reasonable stuff along the way, or even be really progressive and say, you know what, we should create a committee of student athletes and collectively bargain with them so that we create parameters that even they want, right, and that we can live with to move forward. I don't think we would be in the situation that we are in from this, obviously, and like this Wild West NIL. We're in the Wild West of the NIL, yes, right? Yes. We wouldn't be in there. I don't think we'd be in the same conference realignment discussions that we're having. I mean, I think NIL and sort of pay for play is a big driver of what's happened in that regard. And so to act like the kids have, you know, are asserting rights that are out of balance with where it should be, I think is just really short-sighted into the culpability of the NCAA and the powers that be for our entire generation. And they are reaping what they sowed, mm-hmm, for decades.
Hey.
And they put themselves in a position to make the court step in and provide no concrete guidance other than to say these kids got rights.
And not only the NCAA, but while they weren't allowing kids an iota, what they were allowing, how many times have we seen and said, coaches, right, before the transfer portal, and then the transfer portal hit, and we were like, hey, what's good for the goose? But how many times have we seen a coach that just went into a living room and recruited a kid, but then went and took a bigger offer, and sort of they control what they want, and they can come and go as they want, based around what? Dream jobs with big money.
Yeah, this is the standard.
That didn't help.
The standard of loyalty. All that stuff you just mentioned,
yeah.
Who do the athletes learn that from? The coaches, right, and the administrators. Yep. And we see this week, you know, Sluka burned his teammates. I would never do that. You guys switch conferences and say F this to 50, 70, 90-year relationships with other schools,
mm-hmm,
over, you know, a few million dollars. So please stop the greed and hypocrisy. Out of control.
I mean, college football has long been like kind of my number one fandom for the greater part of my adulthood. And man, you know, I'm into this conference realignment and I'm, you know, I'm a backer of Oregon State and my alma mater, and I'm there. I'm going up for the UNLV game, and I try to make a trip back there once a year. But man, it's exhausting, and what it's turning into is not what I love about college athletics. You know, it's not that it's always the best athletes all the time who it's their profession to be an athlete. You know, that's pro sports. That's minors and majors. You know, that's that stuff. What made college great was, you know, that wasn't their full-time job and that they were kids and students. And but that's long gone. That's long. I mean,
they pushed them
into that.
I never thought of that stuff. And I do respect the educational part of it since I'm around it. But I was cynical, like, really early on, even into my teens, about once you started hearing stories about Eric Dickerson and Trans Am, and he's keeping the Trans Am from Texas A&M. I mean, you know, pay for play has been the thing forever. I actually like what's going on now because it's being brought above board. Now, there should be some rules, but, you know, I tell people all the time, like, it wasn't this glamorous thing back in the 70s and 80s and 90s, and even going further back. Powers had money, they bought players. Now, more players across rosters are actually having a little sip at the till, which I think is pretty good. On the conference chaos thing, so the Mountain West Conference has added UTEP for all sports. They're looking for some more football members. Pac-12 made a big brand move yesterday, maybe not necessarily a market move, but a brand nationally for basketball with Gonzaga. For UNLV, as this is slowly developing, did they make the right decision?
I'm biased. I don't think I can completely remove my bias, so I'll just acknowledge it and then give my opinion. I think they made a mistake.
Oregon State guy.
I'm an Oregon State guy. But when you look at metrics of what the new Pac-12 conference is and who makes that up and who the Mountain West is and who makes that up, I think that they're on the wrong side of the fence there, because the metrics I'm talking about is TV viewership, it is in-stadium attendance, it is dollars invested in your athletic budgets. And by all of those metrics, the five best in those measurables left. And everybody else who's in the Mountain West is at the bottom of those. I mean, I'm talking attendance in 10 to 15,000 range. I'm talking about athletic spending in the $10 million range when these other schools are three times that. I'm talking about viewership of TV that's in like the 100,000 person range when, you know, Oregon State, Washington State are in the multiple millions. So I can't and UNLV now recently, if you look at 20 years, they're at the bottom. They're at the bottom of all these measurables. Mm-hmm. If you look at the last 2 years, if you give them their best 2 years, and you look at those last 2 years, they are that bridge team. They are right in the middle. They're working their way towards those top five, but they're not there yet. They don't spend what Utah State spends. They don't spend what Colorado State spends, or Boise State, or San Diego State, or Fresno. They don't spend that much. Their viewership is not that much. Their attendance is not that much. I mean, all of those five schools sell out every one of their games. They got small stadiums, but they sell out. They're in the 30,000 attendance range, all of them. UNLV's not there. I think they had a unique opportunity with what they've got going on currently with the buzz around the program that they would have been included in that group and they would have reaped the benefits from it. But because they are so in debt, they had to take the money now. I think it was irresponsible for the Mountain West to even promise them that money, because I don't think they're getting that money. They promised them basically 25% of every dollar of the exit fees and poaching fees, and I don't think they're getting 100% of either of those. So when that whatever gets settled, when that comes down, they're getting 25% of that. And they're getting 25% of that over 5 years. A lump sum up front and then paid out over 5 years, which works out to a little bit less than $2 million a year after the lump sum. And I think the media deal between the Pac-12 and the Mountain West is going to be well over $2 million difference. I think it's going to be closer to $5 to $10 million difference. And so I don't know the finances of UNLV, but if they were able to absorb it, I think that they really should. One of the things that people have pointed to is, well, UNLV has a term in there that they could leave for a Power Four. Well, terms have come out for the Pac-12 too, and they can too. All of them. Everybody knows everybody needs to try to get to a Power Four conference, and they have all had their exit fees be well below normal exit fees if they get accept a bid to a Power Four. So I think from a biased perspective, I think UNLV made a mistake.
Last 30 seconds here. I don't think it's going to matter. I think this is the current situation is tenable and will survive for another 4 or 5 years. And then I think the big split is going to happen, and it's not going to matter where any of these Pac-12 and Mountain West schools are, because none of them are going to be invited to the top 60. So I look at it like grab all the money you can, get financially right, and then see what it looks like 4 and 5 years from now. But it's a pretty big pipe dream that the big boys are going to take these guys at this level and even the bottom of the current Power Four.
Live from the Battleborn Broadcast Center, it's Cofield and Company on ESPN, Las Vegas, and ESPN, Reno.
All right, we got a couple cases to close on. Thanks for watching our live stream. We try to do that every day during the show. Look for the heads up on Twitter and on Facebook and on YouTube. NASCAR is in a battle, maybe. Yeah. Who's suing NASCAR now?
Michael Jordan and his team.
Okay.
There's two NASCAR charter teams who are suing NASCAR under an antitrust claim, saying basically when you renewed the charter, 13 of the 15 signed on, but it was basically under duress and the other two did not sign on, that the charter is anti-competitive. It limits the team's revenues from their own individual marketing. It does not allow them to engage in any other outside activity outside of NASCAR. Funny enough, the firm that they retained is the same one that that the Pac-12 retained to dispute the poaching fees. Kessler's firm out of the Bay Area. This is what they do. I don't know enough about antitrust law. I've never practiced in that area. I would say this. I don't think those firms take cases that they don't think that they're likely to win. They have a great track record of winning against Major League Baseball, against the NBA, the NFL. They've gone against all of those guys, and they generally win, and they certainly feel like they're in a strong position to argue that NASCAR's behavior is anti-competitive, that it's an antitrust, and that the court should step in and either redefine terms or blow it up all completely.
Justin Watkins with Willie with Cofield. 766-1400 is a call from anywhere in the state of Nevada for Battleborn Injury Lawyers, including the office in Reno. Dial 775 in the north. Headline, Shannon Sharpe defeats Brett Favre in defamation suit appeal.
Yeah, I think this is big. It's big for you guys. I guess it's big for me, too, because I get on here. Yeah. So what this is known is an anti-slap law and a motion to dismiss. What anti-slap is it's a statutory scheme that defends people, could be any people, from a defamation lawsuit where they are discussing matters of public importance and protects their rights and access to the media and to the courts. So actually lawyers rely on anti-slap statutes all the time, because if they get sued for what they say in court or what they say in a pleading or what they say on behalf of their client, they can file a motion to dismiss and say, hey, there's no defamation here. This is public importance. I'm allowed to speak on behalf of my client, talk about the case. And for context, Nevada has perhaps the strongest anti-slap statute in the United States. So media, lawyers, commentators, newscasters are in a very good position in the state of Nevada to defend against defamation lawsuits like this. But what the holding was in here is somewhat unique in that they dove in and said, listen, what Shannon Sharpe said was not factually correct, but we're still going to protect him because he made it clear he was relying on the reporting of a newspaper informing his opinions and coming up with what he said. And because it's not reasonable to expect that somebody in his position is a lawyer and can parse out the technically correct and technically incorrect positions that were taken in that news reporting, his statements and interpretations of what that news said is protected. And basically the statements of, you know, Brett Favre stole from the poor, stole from the people who needed it the most. And they were saying, well, Brett Favre was saying he didn't report that I paid the money back and he should have. And what they said is, if you're relying on reporting and you don't get it technically correct, you're still protected.
That is a big decision. It's always a lot going on, right? Doug Gottlieb had his troubles last year. Because of what we do, we put ourselves in the crosshairs potentially of crossing the line. Justin, we appreciate it. We'll see you next week. There he is. Justin Watkins, Battleborne Injury Lawyers, coming back. Some picks, leans, likes for the NFL. Evan Abrams, Action Network.
It's Cofield and Company's Eye on Sports Gambling, presented by Oasis Bar and Grill. Only on ESPN Las Vegas and ESPN Reno.
Today's expert is Evan Abrams from Action Network. It's Cofield, it's Willie. We have a lot of college football games to go through and hit the trends, and you can get all these trends up on actionnetwork.com. This is interesting. October obviously changes everything after you've got a few games under the belt. And Evan, we bring you in, and I want to start talking about Mike Gundy, who's just been a freaking demon at this point in the season when it comes to betting.
Yeah, ridiculous. 46-25 against the spread over the last 20 years. He's the most profitable coach in our database. We use Bet Labs at Action Network, which is a proprietary system, et cetera, et cetera. But 46-25 against the spread, best of any coach. Second, Brian Kelly. Third, Matt Campbell. So kind of getting an idea there. But the thing I thought of that was kind of more important than that is just more recently. He's 13-3 against spread over the last five seasons in October. So kid does his job no matter what your age is, no matter what the situation is. The interesting thing, though, about that game is kind of the spread. Look ahead was eight down to 3.5. So kind of gives you an idea of what they feel like West Virginia could bring to the table here.
It's pretty incredible how scheduling works. And now with this crazy ACC, you got Miami on the road for the first time in forever in the West. They're still laying a big number at Cal.
Yeah, unreal here. So speaking of heading West in this situation, Miami goes to California. Since 2005, Miami has only played one game in either MST or PST in terms of time zones. Ridiculous. And that was in 2008 at Cal, which it lost 24-17. Means nothing. I think the only thing it means is that it's a bit of an odd scenario. I feel like every time I write this article this week and we kind of look at some of these time zones and distances, college football has completely overhauled everything. So just very interesting that you have all these teams kind of going to places that you haven't had before. We'll talk about in a second with USC and Minnesota, just all sorts of funny and different scenarios. But listen, since 2015, Miami just 8-11 straight up, 5-14 against the number. The game after it had a straight up win, but lost against the spread. So as you saw, that Hail Mary, the craziness, kind of takes it out of you. So we'll see what they do with this number. I'm kind of into Cal. I took the 11.5 early. I know it's down a little bit, but I think it's going to be a bit of a tough spot for them, even after the close win.
Evan Abrams with us from Action Network. You can find him on Twitter at Evan H. Abrams. All right, another new matchup going to the Pacific time zone and vice versa. Michigan's going to be on the road all the way out in Seattle. They're actually getting points here. Washington off a loss against Rutgers. But actually, I liked a lot of what I saw from the Huskies. I thought they nutted up late in the game in terms of being physical. And I think their quarterback-to-receiver combo, Rodgers to Boston, is going to be one of the best in the Big Ten.
Yeah, before I even go to the spiel, I'm on the Huskies money line. I feel it with you. I took it -130 in this one. I just think Michigan's a little overrated in this spot. Cross country, the issue, they've looked really good up to this point, except for the fact that they pretty much blew that entire lead at Minnesota. It just an absolute collapse all around when really they could have just strangled them basically the entire second half. But interesting enough, this is Michigan's first true road game. Almost a year, November 18th last year against Ohio State. Wolverines have won 12 consecutive road games dating back to 2021. I kind of feel like it stops here.
Let's talk totals and specifically overs. Am I actually going to reference an Iowa game and the total looking too low? Ohio State, this is always interesting. Ohio State's laying 19.5, but the total's only 45.5. And I say only, that is a high total for an Iowa game. But, you know, there's that whole thing where, hey, is Ohio State's going to lay this number and cover, they're going to have to basically hold Iowa to nothing.
Yeah, I think the only storyline people will pay attention to here if they've been following college football for a little while is the fact that how low this total is and the fact that Ohio State's in the game. So looking at the total there, they've only played one game with a total of 45 or less, dating all the way back to 2012. That was a game against Rutgers last year. They closed at 44. They won 35-16 on the road. I just think from that point of view, I'm probably going to be on the under in this one and just suck it up. I would want to take Ohio State and lay the points and say they're just going to do their job and win there. Only a few programs can cover a large spread under a low total. I feel like Ohio State might be one of those teams. But to me, it's just a little bit too difficult to handicap because think of it like this. Iowa, again, you mentioned 4-0 to the over. They've absolutely never done that dating back to all my data, 20, 25 years. Iowa's just never started that hot to the over. Now, it has to do with the low totals, but also they were 21-6 to the under over the last 3 years entering this year. So just an absolute turn of the table. So a little bit tough of a handicap, right?
Oh, no doubt. Alabama and Georgia, you know, you come out of this game, you figure, let's say on the Alabama side, you're beat up. That next game might be hard to get up for. What are we looking at with Bama nearly laying 24 on the road against Vandy?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say this off the bat. I like the Vandy at 24.5. I love the QB. I love the spunk. I love what he's put to the table for Vanderbilt. I'm pulling upsets already. He's really made the program top-notch for the conference, in a sense, right? Like, they're showing up in times that they hadn't shown up before. But the number you're referring to, so after Alabama plays Georgia, they've really taken care of business. 12-2 straight up, 8-6 against the spread since 1990 after facing the Bulldogs. So, you know, other than that, I'm just not really sure what to do with this, aside from the fact that Alabama has faced Vanderbilt three times since 2010 with spreads of 40.5, 20, and 29. All three were covered by the Tide. I just feel like it's going to flip in this one.
Evan Abrams with us on Cofield and Company here on ESPN Las Vegas. We're also on up in Reno and Northern Nevada for this hour. So I want to hit a couple of regional games. First, Nevada's taking on San Jose State. I actually think this number is too small. I think San Jose State has a chance to whack the Wolfpack here. I don't love – I mean, I like what I've seen from the Wolfpack, but I don't think their schedule leads me to believe that they're going to be able to stay in this game. And I like what Coach Ken is doing at SJSU.
You and I are on the exact same side, and I like when I hear it. So the look ahead was 10. I like the 6.5. Tickets and the money are all on San Jose State. For Nevada, it's just been ups and downs. I mean, win, loss. But the thing you kind of have to look at from Nevada's point of view, 6-23 since 2022 straight up. So the fact that you have two wins already is a pretty good idea for this school and going forward. So I'm not going to completely crap on Nevada because I do think there is a right direction, quote unquote, in here. But I just think San Jose State's going to throw all over their secondary. San Jose State ranks top 40 in both EPA per play pass, EPA per play rush allowed. I just, to me, they're going to get the number. And 6.5 is kind of key in this scenario. And also from Nevada secondary, I know I mentioned that, 93rd EPA per play pass allowed. So I just think they're going to throw on them.
I'm going to do something here because I have to.
Sure.
So people in the state of Nevada, right? And I grew up on the East Coast and I thought it was Nevada and Oregon and, you know, Louisville. I'm telling you, people go ape, you know what?
Yeah, I know.
When they hear it the way you said it. So I never do this, but I was like, oh no, the listeners. And then here's the thing. If I don't correct it, they're like, what are you doing?
I get it. I understand. Right. I'll say this. Born and raised in New York City. Yeah. I've got an accent. It's going to come out. Oh, there's nothing I can do there. As long as I'm calling Fremont Street, as long as I don't do that, I think I'm all right.
Don't do that. Don't do Fremont. Okay, so UNLV has been a story this year. They were a story last year, but this year has been even better. They're playing better defense. They're going against Syracuse. Syracuse can really throw the ball. I think this number has gotten a little too big because I have a feeling it's going to be a high-scoring game. And again, UNLV's defense is going to be tested all over the field with their pass defense.
Yeah, it's probably a test they haven't faced before. And you talk about the line. Look ahead, -4, up to 6.5. Barry Odom, cover machine. I mean, he's 13-5, with the run in Rebels, which kind of just says enough in itself in the fact that how he's turned around the program. But then you look 14-4 against the number. So cover machine, they're 4-0 straight up and against the spread. One of few teams in the country that have done that entering this game. But I agree with you. I think the number is a tad too high. I'm going to pass on the number. 54.5, I'm looking right now as a look ahead, up to 58.5. I don't think it's high enough.
Yeah, I think both teams are going to score. But guess what? I said that last week. I thought Fresno would go up and down the field. It'll be a game played in the 30s, and they freaking obliterated Fresno. And also Mikey Keene on that Sam Darnold line from the past, I think he was seeing ghosts. Like, he got freaked. And I think mentally he was out of it by the third quarter. Evan Abrams is with us. Let's wrap on a couple NFL spots. Sure. And I know some of these games are weird spots, but throughout the week with all our experts, I like to try to cover every game. This is kind of bottom of the barrel, but I'm really intrigued right now by what's going on with the Dolphins. Huntley as a guy who's going to start the game, how much of a difference does that make? And what do you think of the Dolphins and Patriots? Basically a coin flip.
Yeah, so when I looked at this number and I'm analyzing game by game by game, the first thing that came to mind is I looked at the total. I looked at the total and then I said to myself, well, how about we check the weather? And I looked at the weather and I said, okay, nothing. So this total is at 35.5, and I looked it up. 36 or under for the total with under 5 mile an hour winds is 34-20-3 to the over the last 20 years, 63%. So I tend to believe somehow, some way, we are going to find points in this game. When Miami scored 45 points through four games and has barely outscored Brandon Aubrey this season, I still think there's going to be a way to find points in this one. The thing that I look at, which is just funny in itself, and I know this line's sitting kind of at one, Dolphins have been favored versus the Patriots in just 6 of 42 games since 2003. So, you know, either way, this might close one way or the other. But just funny to kind of look at this line and you realize who's playing quarterback. And, you know, if it was Tua, it'd be a completely different story and the line would be completely shifted. But the one fear I have when looking at Miami, and I think I would probably like to back Miami in this one, Mike McDaniel, 19-21 against the spread in his pro coaching career, 17-16 with Tua, reasonable, 2-5 with Bridgewater, Huntley, and Skyler. So he just hasn't been able to find any type of offense. And then you look across the league, you have so many other coaches who have backup quarterbacks, Malik Willis. You can go on and on and on, and you've seen Andy Dalton, you can say yes or no, but backup sort of, and everyone's putting up numbers except for them. So I think it's an issue.
Last one, quandary to solve here, because we have a show entry in Circa Millions, and we're talking to Evan Abrams. And last week we bombed out, and I made a terrible pick. I had been unbeaten on the season, but I'm consistently a dog player. And the dog I wanted to take was the Broncos plus the 7.5. I didn't take it. It was a stupid pick. So I'm looking at the card this week. Do I have a chance with either one of these? I can get the Rams plus. I can also get the Cardinals plus against the Niners up to a touchdown. We'll see what the number is set on Thursday. So either one of those dogs have a chance to cover?
Oh, man. So Sunday night podcast, we were talking about look-ahead lines just for this week and anything that stood out to me. And I obviously put my foot in the bucket and said I liked Arizona at 7.5. So I, you know, no matter what the numbers will tell you, and listen, Purdy in his career, when he's favored by 4 points or more, 9-12 against the number. 3.5 points or less, he's 8-2 against the number. So I think with the fact that you're just getting the hook here was just a bet I had to make. But you got to understand, Purdy's faced the Cardinals 3 times. He's 3-0 straight up and against the spread. But the spreads in those games were 12.5, 15, and 14.5.
Wow.
But listen, he's faced David Blau, Josh Dobbs, and Kyler once. So you kind of got to assume coming off that bad game last week where Kyler just looked like he was a dog in the pocket, just kind of rolling in circles and kind of getting hit. I think things might change. The only thing that scares me a tad is Arizona's secondary is putrid. So, and Purdy's been, if you look at the numbers, last year and 4 weeks this year, he's the same quarterback. So I don't necessarily think he's changed at all. Just as efficient, completion percentage basically up there as well. It's scary, but I don't know what to do but take Arizona.
Evan, one more time, give the Vegas audience the skinny on what's up on Action Network.
Sure. Evan H. Abrams on Twitter. You've got both of my college football and NFL articles. You can just click my author name and find all of my action on there. And I'm on the Action Network podcast. Sunday night, we do NFL recap. And Tuesday, I'm on the Roundtable where we have different guests all over the network. Come find me and interact. I'm happy to help.
That was great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.